And Young, it's here and now. The plan to withdraw American troops from Iraq has been killed after Senate Democrats failed to break a Republican filibuster. Senators held a rare sleepover session, eating cold pizza, grabbing catnaps on cuts, some engaging in bleary-eyed debate on the measure that would begin to bring U.S. troops home within 120 days. Democrats, though, fell 8 votes short of the 60 needed to break a filibuster. And joining us from the Capitol is John Bresnahan, Capitol Hill bureau chief for Politico.com. John, you were there all night, I understand?
I was. It was a real long night.
Well, Democrats had hoped the overnight session would draw attention to their cause, pressure Republicans who are on the fence to vote with them to break the filibuster. But it was thought going into the night that the measure didn't stand a chance. Did they move anyone?
No, they didn't appear to move anyone. Though I think, you know, I think both sides gained from the debate, several Republicans came to the floor and complained that what Reid was doing, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, by holding the all-night session, was actually hardening opposition to any kind of withdrawal plan at this point. So, but Democrats felt it was important that they really had to bring attention to this issue, that if the Republicans are going to filibuster a proposal like this, then they got to stand there and filibuster.
And perhaps send a message to some of their core support that they are trying to do something to move the debate on Iraq. Senate Majority Leader Reid had threatened to have the Sergeant of Arms call back senators to the Senate chamber if they didn't, you know, show up last night. We remember another scene where that actually happened. I think it was 1988.
Yes, Bob Packwood, former Senator Bob Packwood from Oregon. They actually had to get into his office. He was actually in a closet. They had to bring him in to the floor. They literally carried him into the floor.
Because he failed to show up for a vote. Were there any kind of similar strong-arm tactics last night?
No, they didn't need to do that. Most senators stayed put in. In fact, there was a 5 a.m. Quorum call, and then a surprising number of senators showed up. They kind of rotated. Some senators missed all the votes, but for instance, Barack Obama, Senator Obama, he missed a 9 o'clock vote, but he was there for midnight. He had been in Cincinnati and showed up for a midnight vote. Senator Hillary Clinton, she was there. Most of the presidential candidates were there, and most of the leaders were there. One notable exception: Senate Minority Whip Trent Lott. He didn't show up for any of these votes.
Well, and I heard others. Lindsey Graham, I think, said he slept through the whole thing. Well, Democrats. Senators Carl Levin of Michigan and Jack Reed of Rhode Island sponsored the amendment. Remind us briefly exactly what it called for.
The amendment would have called for, if it was passed, the U.S. would have begun a withdrawal of combat troops beginning in 120 days from the time it was enacted. And by April 30th, 2008, the United States would have only had a limited presence in Iraq. And those troops, and it was never specified how many troops under a limited presence there would be, would not be engaged in a direct combat role. They would be involved in protecting U.S. assets in Iraq. They would be involved in counterterrorism. And they would be involved in training Iraqi security forces. But they would not taking a direct combat role. That would shift to the Iraq security forces.
Now, how did yesterday's release of the National Intelligence Estimate play into the overnight debate?
Well, it was fascinating. You could see the tone in, frankly, the last couple of days, especially coming out of President Bush and the Republicans, that al-Qaeda was the main enemy in Iraq, and that has kind of been an underlying issue in the debate. But the Republicans used the NIE, which is a report by 16 intelligence agencies, to say, look, if we pull out of Iraq, it will become a safe haven for Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they will use that base to strike against the United States. The Democrats, on the other hand, said, look, the NIAE, what exactly it says is that Al-Qaeda is as strong as it was at any point before September 11, 2001, or just about as strong. They were resurgent. The war has failed. We failed to crush Al-Qaeda. We failed to permanently damage them. And so that, you know, we've spent, you know, thousands of lives and hundreds of billions of dollars and really have no significant result in the war on terror. So both sides kind of cherry-picked and used what they wanted for the debate.
Mentioning that the Al-Qaeda, the report also says that Al-Qaeda is actually holed up on the Afghan-Pakistan border. Well, so what happens next in the few seconds we have?
Well, they're going to pull the bull right now, and then I think that Senate Majority Leader Reid's going to have to figure out another way of passing this. It's not sure if they'll be able to do this before the August recess. If not, this will come back up in September. We'll have to pass a funding bill for the for 2008, and then of course the General Petraeus is coming into town in mid-September to give his report on the status of the surge. So this will be back up in a couple of weeks, but I think it's a win that the Democrats wanted, but they knew it was going to be a tough one.
John Bresnahan, Capitol Hill bureau chief for Politico.com, speaking about the failed attempt to push through a proposal in the Senate to withdraw American troops from Iraq within 120 days. John, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Well, this Congress has also tabled immigration reform, and that recent tussle reminded us of another. The laws against Chinese immigrants in the late 1800s and the violent campaign against Chinese immigrant workers at the same time. When college professor Gene Felser went to teach American studies at Humboldt State University in Arcata, California in 1974, she noticed that the student body there was a mixture of white and Native American students, but there were no Asian American faces. When she asked why, she was told that no Chinese parents would send their children to Humboldt because 90 years before, all the Chinese living in Eureka, the Humboldt County seat, had been forcibly expelled. What, she said, an ethnic cleansing? As Professor Felser looked into it, she found that in the 1800s, thousands of Chinese were herded onto railroad cars, marched on foot out of town, sometimes burned out of their homes, sometimes killed, in what the Chinese called the Pai Hua, or the driven out. But they didn't go quietly. Although the court system was set up against them, the Chinese were not allowed to bear witness. They constantly waged legal battles to recover their losses that were the forerunners of modern-day reparations lawsuits. Jean Feltzer shares her findings in the new book, Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans, and she joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
This is both fascinating and very tough, grim reading. Page after page of assaults on Chinese with dozens of footnotes backing up your research. Did you have any idea of the magnitude you were going to find when you began?
When I first looked into the story, I was truly looking for my missing Chinese American students. But the first day, as I went through reels and reels of dusty microfilm, I quickly realized, there goes Petaluma, there goes Los Angeles, there goes Eureka, there goes Seattle, city upon city, up and down the Pacific Northwest, out to Denver. And I knew that within a few hours, I had found a very troubling buried history of ethnic cleansing in the United States.
Can you give us a brief overview? Why were the Chinese here in the first place? They started because of the gold rush, right?
There's a difference between why the Chinese men and why the Chinese women were here.
Right.
The Chinese men come as free laborers. They start with the gold rush, with the same dreams people from Chile, Mexico, Argentina, Peru, the East Coast of the United States had, to strike it rich, to find easy money, to find their way out of economic hard times. The Chinese women come here as slaves. They're kidnapped from the port cities in southern China and Hong Kong, and they're brought, even as babies, to grow up and work as prostitutes. A few merchants are allowed to bring their wives in, but most of the first Chinese American women came here as enslaved prostitutes.
And bought, in many cases, by the Chinese men.
Yes, there were dens in Chinatown and dens up in the Sierra foothills, where Chinese girls were sold as prostitutes.
The Chinese workers also came to build the Transcontinental Railroad, though, as you and others point out, once the railroad was finished, they weren't in any of the celebratory photos. They were soon fired. When the gold rush subsided, they planted vegetables. They worked canning fish. Why were they such a threat?
There are several explanations of why the Chinese were targeted. One is, and the most common one, is jobs. These were a period of economic depressions in the United States, and the Chinese were blamed for taking jobs that might have gone to white workers.
Let's stop there. Did they actually take jobs that would have gone to white workers?
No, like recent immigrants today, they took jobs that white workers wouldn't take. In fact, they were kicked out of the mining fields almost immediately as soon as they arrived, and took jobs in the service sector as cooks, in laundries, working in boarding houses, occasionally as nannies. In addition to claiming that the Chinese were taking their jobs, there were many other reasons why the Chinese were purged from towns from Seattle down through San Diego. One was that the Chinese appeared different. The men were smaller. They wore their hair in long braids. They lived in all bachelor communities. So there was this projection of difference. There was a fear of foreignness. This is right after the Civil War, and the Southern Democrats have taken over the West. They've got the governor's mansion in California. Many of the mayors are Southern Democrats. They control the county board of supervisors, and they bring the Jim Crow laws with them to the West Coast.
Yeah, the Democratic Party does not come off looking very well in this time in history. In a sense, there's a sense that they lost the war in the East and moved a lot of the prejudices west and transplanted feelings about black slaves toward Chinese workers.
Also in the West at the same time, much later than the East Coast, is the movement to force Native Americans onto reservations. So there's a model, a template for a mass removal of a people that's happening in the Pacific Northwest at exactly the same time as the hostility and the purges of Chinese Americans.
Right. In fact, some of the stories you tell, some of the anecdotes, are purging of both Chinese and Native Americans. But you were saying how the Chinese were demonized because of their looks. They had these long single braids called queues. They were considered evil, dirty. The women were said to be spreading disease. The Chinese men, people were very unsettled by the fact that many of them lived together, as workers do. And, you know, there were questions about their sexuality. They were quite the other.
In fact, I think that a lot of the hostility against the first Chinese Americans was because their lives were so similar to the lives of the white working class and indeed the white middle class. Everybody was dirty on the frontier. Everybody was underfed. There were problems of nutrition. There were all bachelor communities and fears of homophobia. People had come from all over the world, from Eastern Europe, from Ireland, from Germany. Everyone was different. And I believe that a lot of the hostility against Chinese Americans was, as people looked at Chinese Americans, they saw themselves, and white people saw some of their worst fears realized in Chinese Americans. White people saw within the Chinese community their busted dreams.
And poor whites didn't want to see in the Chinese what they didn't want to see in themselves.
Indeed. It's also important to remember that a lot of these were rural towns, and this was a cross-class movement. In Tacoma, Washington, where they drive out the Chinese in 4 hours, in the mud, in the rain, the movement was led by the mayor, the chief of police, the fire chief, the members of the county board of supervisors, endorsed by the governor. So this was not just the Irish going after the Chinese. This was an attempt to create white communities and find a kind of racial coherence in new raw towns in the West.
Gene Feltzer's book is Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans. We'll have more after a quick break, Here and Now. It's Here and Now, and we're back with more from Gene Feltzer, author of Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans. It describes how in the late 1800s, thousands of Chinese immigrants were violently driven from their homes in the American West. Jamie, we want to hear about how the Chinese fought back through the courts. First, can you read us some of the recorded testimony in one of these cases? It's a man named Lum Mei describing what happened to him and his family when they were forced to leave the Chinatown in Tacoma, Washington.
My wife refused to go, and some of the white persons dragged her out of the house. From the excitement, the fright, and the losses we sustained through the riot, she lost her reason and has ever since been hopelessly insane. She threatens to kill people with a hatchet or any other weapon she can get hold of. The outrages I and my family suffered at the hands of the mob has utterly ruined me. I make no claim, however, for my wife's insanity or the anguish I have suffered. My wife was perfectly sane before the riot. I saw my countrymen marched out of Tacoma on November 3rd. They presented a sad spectacle. Some had lost their trunks, some their blankets. Some were crying for their things. Armed white men were behind the Chinese, on horseback, sternly urging them on. It was raining and blowing hard. On the 5th of November, all the Chinese houses situated on the wharf were burnt down by incendiaries.
As you read it, it seems impossible, you know, that it would happen. You know, you picture people, torches in their hands, kind of a scene out of Frankenstein or something, you know, going to get the monster, but they're going to the Chinatowns in the various towns. But explain to us, they were aided by the law. The immigration of Chinese was curtailed under the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which was the first immigration law aimed at a specific ethnic group. Tell us more about how the law at the time was at first the underpinning of these purges.
There were a series of very troubling immigration laws. The 1882 Exclusion Act is the first law targeted against a race where no Chinese laborers or laborers' wives were allowed in the country. Before that, in 1875, is a bizarre act called the Page Act, which says no Chinese woman may enter the United States. In 1892, the Geary Act says that all Chinese people have to bear on their person a photo identity card, a law that we are now seeing revisited in the Patriot Act and Real ID.
The Geary Act was, you know, really hotly debated in the country at the time. But it seems as if all of this, all the purges, the laws that were passed, had an impact on the Chinese community till the mid-1900s.
Chinese are not allowed to immigrate into the United States until 1943. In 1943, the United States is at war with Japan, China's at war with Japan, and as a sop to China, the Chinese Exclusion Act is ended. But at that point, the quota is set in, and only 105 Chinese people are allowed each year into the country.
And that's changed wildly since that time.
Indeed.
Yeah. Tell us more about the Chinese government's role. At first, they supported their workers in the U.S., but that concern was trumped by a desire for trade with the U.S.?
Initially, China did not allow any Chinese person to emigrate. It was seen as a betrayal of the motherland, a betrayal of the emperor. As Chinese merchants see what is coming down on Chinese miners, on Chinese farm workers, on Chinese laborers, they really push the government of China to send a legation, to send Chinese consuls. And the Chinese consuls on the ground see what's happening to the Chinese people. And they really force the government of China to raise serious protests with the government of the United States. And this lasts until the 1890s, when China sells out the first Chinese Americans in return for trade. I think it's important to understand that what Native Americans didn't have and what African Americans didn't have was China. China to fund the lawsuits, to find the lawyers, to put pressure and leverage on the United States government. And it was a formidable force that was helpful in uniting Chinese Americans.
As you document, the thing that does distinguish the oppression of Chinese from other oppressions is that the Chinese fought continuously for their rights in court. And it's amazing to watch them go back and go into court and say, I was kicked out of Portland, Oregon, or wherever it was, and you owe me $1,000 for the laundry that I had that's still there.
The Chinese filed the first lawsuits for damages and reparations. For example, in Eureka, a lumber and fishing town in Northern California, very near the Oregon border, they file within hours of being driven out of town, a brutal weekend, the ships land in San Francisco, and they regather, and they announce that they're going to sue the city of Eureka for over $130,000 in damages. But they also sue for being the objects of mob violence. They sue for racism. They lose that one, but they win over $250,000 in the late 19th century for acts that are done to them by white vigilantes, by white mayors, by white governors. This is a formidable history that was very moving and inspiring to me as I uncovered it.
And as the Chinese displayed, they were here to stay. I mean, against, odds, you know, why would you want to stay with that kind of, you know, being burned out, being killed? But they wanted to stay.
If the subtitle of the book is called The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans, I believe the Chinese win that war. They do stay in this country, not necessarily in the 200 towns that attempted to drive them out, although in places like San Jose and Los Angeles, California, they do stay. But they are finally able to bring women to have families, to have children, and to become part of the fabric, to be inscribed in the history of the United States.
Jean Feltzer, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Her book is Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, another history lesson. Why haven't more of us heard of Gertrude Bell? More famous in her day than her good friend Lawrence of Arabia, she helped create modern Iraq, is still revered there. We'll hear why her story resonates today. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, great music from Ella, Joni, and their admirers. That's after the news, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. Even though the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Los Angeles agreed this past weekend to pay a record $660 million settlement with 508 victims of clergy sexual abuse, the case against the L.A. Church is not over. The district attorney is still weighing criminal charges against top officials, including Cardinal Roger Mahoney, depending on how many confidential church records are released under the settlement. But that's Los Angeles. Does a major settlement in the nation's most populous diocese mean the worst is over for the American Catholic Church? Joining us from San Francisco is Father Thomas Reese, who's an expert on U.S. bishops and a senior fellow at the Woodstock Theological Center at Georgetown University. Father, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with Los Angeles. What do you think? Do you think the worst is over there?
Well, I think it's the end of the beginning. The sexual abuse crisis in the United States is the worst crisis that the Catholic Church has experienced in its history. The damage that it did to children is just awful. I mean, they are scarred for life, and it's a tragedy, it's a crime, it's a sin that should never have been committed. And, you know, the Church needs to apologize continually for this and to do everything it can to help heal these people so that they can live their lives.
But what do you see as some of the issues still to be dealt with, even though there's been this huge settlement? Some observers are saying, how can Cardinal Mahoney, for instance, move on and talk about his favorite issues that relate to social justice, for instance, when in their view, he hasn't really owned this issue? He hasn't, for instance, given up the documents, the confidential documents that the district attorney wants. So, you know, do you see that as a looming problem? What do you see as some of the things that the L.A. Church in particular will now have to deal with?
Yes. Well, part of the settlement is that all of the documents will now be handed over to a judge who will decide, a retired judge, who will decide which documents can legally be released. Cardinal Mahoney has argued that under the laws of the state of California, there are certain documents like psychiatric evaluations and exams that an employer cannot release under privacy laws. Now that's out of his hands and in the hands of a judge who hopefully knows the law and will decide what gets released and what doesn't.
How do you see him being received by his followers? I mean, he has apologized for at least two priests that he moved after learning that they had been credibly accused, shifted them to other positions where I think at least one molested again. But as has been revealed through the, you know, the litigation, the diocese kept folders, kept files, kept these confidential files on accused priests, moved many of them around. How do you see him functioning as a leader?
Well, this is going to be the $660 million
right
question. You know, I've always felt that if at the very beginning of this crisis, some bishops had stood up and said, gee, I did this, I made a mistake, I didn't realize, you know, how bad this was, how compulsive these people were, I take full responsibility and I resign. If some of the bishops had done this 20 years ago, even 5 years ago, we wouldn't be where we are today. The fact that only Cardinal Law has been forced to resign under this during this crisis.
Cardinal Law of Boston.
Is extraordinary, yes. On the other hand, Cardinal Mahoney has admitted that he made mistakes. He's apologized for it. You know, and it's up to the people of Los Angeles to decide, well, they're going to weigh the good things he's done over the, you know, since he became bishop in 1985 versus the bad things he did, and are they going to want him to continue on as bishop? I don't know the answer to that question.
Do you think it will just be up to the parishioners, or do you think there might be a criminal case? Again, he left 16 priests in their parishes for up to 13 years. I mean, do you think there might be a criminal case?
I'm not a criminal lawyer, but if the district attorney can indict, why hasn't he indicted? I kind of doubt that the archbishop is going to be indicted or convicted of any crime.
In fact, you've been quoted as saying, you know, you feel that there might be a big burst of publicity around this issue for a few weeks, then it'll be on the back pages and then disappear.
I'm talking as a social scientist and as a former journalist. That's reality. The world moves on to the next big news story. The tragedy is that all of the attention that's been given to the sexual abuse problem in the United States is not being put into the wider context that we have an epidemic of sexual abuse in this country. We have 900 to 150,000 cases of sexual abuse every year in the United States. The tragedy is that so far the Catholic Church has been part of the problem rather than part of the solution.
In fact, critics say that it's far from over because of the aftermath. Victims say church leaders have refused to create a public database on problem priests. Church leaders have said that they could be sued for slander if they do such a thing, but some lay people have come up with their own databases. But critics also say the church hasn't come up with a way to supervise clergy who have been credibly accused but whose crimes can no longer be prosecuted. And it's a real conundrum because if those clergy members are laicized, you know, just sort of kicked out of the church, then there's no way of tracking them.
Well, I mean, there is clearly disagreements between victims themselves over what the church should do. More and more of these priests are simply being forcibly laicized, and frankly, the criminal justice system is not very good at dealing. The Catholic Church no longer has an inquisition or jails or a police force to deal with these people.
Well, Father Reese, we have time for just one last quick question. Some church members say they feel the church has been strengthened by this, that at least now children know to speak out, and it's a much more transparent issue. But the church has paid out more than $1.5 billion in abuse-related costs since 1950. More than 13,000 abuse claims have been filed against priests since then. It's hard not to see a church diminished financially, socially, spiritually. Where do you see the church?
Oh, I totally agree. I think it's been devastating on the church. You know, this means that there are lots of programs that are going to have to be cut and are being cut. The biggest crime, though, and the biggest tragedy is how it's affected these children, these people. And that's why we have been putting in place training programs for clergy, putting people through police background checks. So there's been some progress, but we're going to have to stay very vigilant, just like all of American society needs to be vigilant on this problem.
Father Thomas Reese, Senior Fellow at the Woodstock Theological Center at Georgetown University. Father Reese, thanks for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay, and a quick reminder, you can listen to Here Now anytime at our website. We stream live at noon East Coast time at here-now.org, where you can also download a podcast. Before we go today, tribute CDs to two musical muses, Joni Mitchell and Ella Fitzgerald. You're listening to Here and Now. Congress is debating legislation that would put the Food and Drug Administration in the odd position of approving a product, even though it kills thousands of people a year. A key Senate subcommittee is expected to vote next week on a bill that would give the FDA oversight of cigarettes. Backers say they hope this will lead to a less lethal cigarette. Opponents of the idea say there is no such thing. Dr. Michael Siegel is professor of public health at Boston University, and he's one of the opponents of the new bill. He joins us now. Doctor, as you know, other supporters, like Dr. David Burns of the University of California, say this proposed legislation would authorize the FDA to set standards, national standards, so that tobacco products can be controlled in the way that they're made, and it would force the disclosure of their ingredients. It would limit toxins and regulate marketing, so, you know, it would keep cigarettes from being marketed to kids. Why aren't these all good things?
Well, the idea of regulating cigarettes may sound like a good one. The problem is that there is no such thing as a safety standard for a product that, when used as directed, kills the people that it uses. 400,000 people a year die from cigarettes.
But what if that could be cut in half by the FDA limiting toxins, for instance?
Well, unfortunately, there is simply no evidence that you could make it a safer cigarette. There are over 4,000 chemicals in cigarettes. Even if the FDA were to ban 100 of those substances, you'd still have 3,900 chemicals in there. And there's no evidence that cutting it from 4,000 to 3,900 is going to do anything to protect health. The problem is we're not going to know for many years. And so what this bill does is it basically asks the FDA to approve cigarettes. And this is going to give the public the perception that cigarettes now have an FDA stamp of approval.
The FDA's commissioner, Dr. Andrew von Eschenbach, seems to agree with your concern. He doesn't want his agency to be in the position of seeming to improve something that still kills people. And at first blush, it would seem to be a good thing, because wouldn't the FDA, if they were to oversee cigarettes, simply ban them? It's inconceivable that the FDA would allow a product to be approved if it still killed. And yet we see in the bill, banning cigarettes is not going to be allowed. Your thoughts on that?
Well, basically, I think what people probably don't realize is that this bill was largely written by Philip Morris. And Philip Morris insisted that there be certain provisions in the bill to prevent the FDA from taking action that really would do something to put a dent in smoking. There are several things the FDA could do that would really make a difference. One is to ban cigarettes outright. Another would be to eliminate the nicotine. Another would be to raise the legal age of purchase of cigarettes. Another would be to ban the types of outlets that can sell cigarettes. And another would be to make sure that cigarettes could be sold only by prescription. All of those measures, which would be effective, are specifically precluded by this legislation. So what this legislation really is a huge favor to Philip Morris to give it special protections that no other food and drug has.
But still in all, there's a push now to get this legislation passed by backers who say, look, if we can just make a dent in cigarette smoking, it's worth it. You know, it seems really odd that we're even debating a product that kills, as you said, 400,000 people a year. If it were from China, you know, it would seem to be a different kind of argument. Do you think one element here is that this is just a horse that's gotten out of the barn? Americans want their cigarettes, and there's just nothing really that, even if the FDA did ban them, they'd just go underground.
Well, I think that's really true. I think that society has made a decision that although cigarettes kill, it's the leading preventable cause of disease, that we're not really ready to prohibit the product. And that's exactly the paradox of giving the FDA regulatory authority over cigarettes. You can't ask the FDA to regulate the safety of a product that kills 400,000 people and then tell them, oh, by the way, you can't ban it. You can't get rid of it. That's what the FDA does. It puts drugs on the market when they're safe. I mean, when Vioxx was found to have several cases of heart disease, the FDA didn't say, okay, we're going to regulate the safety of Vioxx. They said, pull it off the market. No questions asked. It seems ludicrous to me to have the FDA on the one hand approving cigarettes and on the other hand approving the chemotherapies that are going to be used to treat those people who get sick because of their smoking. How can the FDA approve both?
Dr. Michael Siegel, professor of public health at Boston University. Well, Congress is going to be voting on this proposed legislation. They were supposed to vote today, but of course there's a lot going on in Washington. It was postponed till next week. We'll see how it falls out. Dr. Siegel, thanks very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Okay, what do Joni Mitchell and Ella Fitzgerald have in common? Well, for one thing, Katie Lang sings tributes to both on new CDs. That's after a minute break, Here and Now. Young, it's Here and Now.
Heard it in the wind last night. sounded like applause. Did you get around resounding for you way up here?
The sounds of goddess, I'm sorry, I mean singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell. That's For the Roses from the 1972 album of the same name. 35 years later, here's Cassandra Wilson's version.
I get these notes on butterflies, lilac sprays from girls who just have to tell me they saw me somewhere.
That's from the album A Tribute to Joni Mitchell. It's one of two new CDs that pay homage to two great, although very different, ladies of song. The other CD is We All Love Ella, celebrating the First Lady of Song. Artists such as Natalie Cole, Chaka Khan, and Katie Lang singing music that jazz great Ella Fitzgerald made famous. Well, here to give us her take on both CDs, our own Lady of Song, Here and Now's pop culture critic, Renee Graham. Renee, welcome as always.
Hi, Robin.
Let's talk first about the Joni Mitchell album. We want to listen to a little of her song, A Case of You, my personal nomination for one of the best songs of all time. Do you agree?
Mine as well.
Okay. She covered herself. She recorded the original on the album Blue, and then on Both Sides Now, she has a symphonic version. Let's listen.
Oh, I am a lonely painter. I live in a box of paints. I'm frightened by the devil. And I'm drawn to those ones that ain't afraid.
So that's Joni Mitchell with her own cover of her song, A Case of You, now from the tribute album, Prince. Let's listen.
I'm a lonely painter. I live in a box of paints. I used to be frightened by the devil and drawn to those ones that weren't afraid.
Whoa. Why do I get the feeling Prince used to sing along to Joni Mitchell's CDs?
Prince is a huge Joni Mitchell fan. You can hear sort of snippets of Joni Mitchell's style, and going back to even some of his earliest albums, Joni Mitchell in interviews has talked about how Prince would write her fan letters. And he would come to her shows and sit in the front row, and he would just be staring in rapt attention while she performed. I mean, there's a real kind of musical love affair that goes on between these two artists, and you really hear it on his version of A Case of You.
So do you think it worked, though? I mean, it's one thing to pay tribute and to have adoration of another artist, but was it worth him making the new version?
I think for tribute to work, it has to do two things. It has to be a true homage to the original artist, but it also has to be a great recording in its own right, and I think Prince accomplishes that with his version of A Case of You. Not sure that's the case in some of the other selections on the Joni Mitchell tribute, though.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's the question. Will it send you back to your Joni Mitchell CDs?
Well, one tricky thing, I think, with Joni Mitchell is she's such an idiosyncratic singer, it's almost hard to imagine other people interpreting her songs. They're so written for her voice and her style and those sort of strange and beautiful inflections she has when she sings that, you know, when you have someone who's doing that and you miss that's missing, the song begins to sort of lose something. And it doesn't have the same charge and the same power that it has with Joni Mitchell doing her own music.
Well, we're going to come back to hear more from the new tribute album to Joni Mitchell, but let's listen to a little of the Ella Fitzgerald tribute. When singer Natalie Cole was asked what young musicians could learn from Fitzgerald, she said, pitch, phrasing, tell the story, sing the song, pitch, 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 you know, just stay on tune. Let's listen to a little of her A Tisket, A Tasket, and we'll ask if you think she does that.
A tisket, a tasket, a brown and yellow basket. Well, I wrote a letter to my mommy. On the way, I dropped it.
Now, a big difference here. These are songs that Ella Fitzgerald made her own, but she didn't write them.
Exactly. That's the big difference between these two tribute albums. Joni Mitchell is a singer-songwriter. Ella Fitzgerald was a singer. She interpreted, you know, the Great American Songbook, even though she does share a co-writing credit for A Tisket, A Tasket, which was her breakthrough hit in 1938.
Let's listen to a little of Ella singing her own song.
She was trucking on down the avenue. But not a single thing to do. She went peck, peck, pecking all around.
when she spied it on the ground, she took.
You know, Renee, I'm listening and I'm thinking that Natalie Cole had it right. It's so hard because it's so simple.
It is. It's such a playful song, and there's such this sort of girlish joy in Ella Fitzgerald's voice, and she was quite young. And if you listen to that, it's performed with the Chick Webb Orchestra. It's not even the Ella Fitzgerald voice that people came to know in the 40s and 50s. It's very much someone who's still developing her own style, but singing within the confines of being, you know, the girl singer in a big band. Mm-hmm. What Natalie Cole does, Natalie Cole certainly knows her way around a jazz riff, and she really expands that as her version goes on, and she does a lot of scat singing. If you're going to do a tribute to Ella Fitzgerald, you have to have someone who knows how to scat sing, and Natalie Cole can do that, and it makes the song really charming.
So it works. I mean, I would imagine in this case it would be so important for her that it worked, because she knew Ella Fitzgerald. She called her Auntie Ella. Ella appeared on Natalie Cole's father's show.
It's very personal for Natalie Cole, and you can tell that she wants to get it right. And it's interesting, she also appears on the album a second time doing a duet with Chaka Khan on You'll Have to Swing It, Mr. Paganini, which is also done quite well. But what's interesting to me when I listened to it was that all I kept thinking was it took two singers to do what Ella Fitzgerald was able to do by herself.
Ooh, Mr. Paganini.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, don't you be meaning.
What have you up your sleeve? Come on in. Spring it.
What else stands out on the Ella album for you?
Something I really like on the Ella album is K.D. Lang's Angel Eyes, which I think really works. K.D. Lang actually is on both albums. The thing you get to do with Ella Fitzgerald, since Ella Fitzgerald didn't write these songs and they've been interpreted by so many singers, is there's a lot of room to put your own spin on it. And K.D. Lang's version falls somewhere between Ella Fitzgerald's version and the Frank Sinatra version that appeared on his album Sings for Only the Lonely in the 1950s. And it's just a beautiful, lush vocal. She doesn't know not a lot of tricks, but she doesn't really have to do it. She lets the song really sell itself.
I try to think that love's not around. Still, it's uncomfortably near.
Well, and as you mentioned, K.D. Lang also is on the Joni Mitchell tribute album with one of Joni's biggest hits, Help Me. Let's listen to a little of that.
Help me, I think I'm falling in love again. When I get that crazy feeling, I know I'm in trouble again.
There's K.D. Lang. Here's Joni Mitchell.
'Cause you're a rambler and a gambler and a sweet-talking ladies' man. And you love your loving. Not like you love your freedom.
So, Renee, how did K.D. Lang do?
She does a spot on version of Joni Mitchell's original. It takes a lot of nerve to do that. It's a difficult song to sing, and Lord knows I've tried to sing it many times in my car and have yet to succeed. But K.D. Lang has the voice, and I think that's the thing. You know, a tribute album doesn't have to be your own wild interpretation. She does a Joni Mitchell song in Joni Mitchell's style, and K.D. Lang actually has the voice to pull it off. I think it's quite effective.
So here we have these two tribute albums, a tribute to Joni Mitchell, and We All Love Ella, celebrating the First Lady of Song. You know, is it run out and buy? Buy if there's one song that you particularly love. Buy if you like one of the artists who's doing the cover. How would you?
All things being fair, I would say to people, you know, go out and buy Joni Mitchell's Court and Spark or Blue, or go out and buy Ella Fitzgerald's Clap Hands, Here Comes Charlie. But if you're going to choose between these two albums, which are very different, I would say the more successful and the better of the two is definitely the Ella Fitzgerald tribute.
We've been talking about Joni Mitchell and Ella Fitzgerald and their tribute albums with Here Now's pop culture critic Renee Graham. Renee, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
You're walking along the street, or you're at a party, or else you're alone, and then you suddenly dig. You're looking at someone's eyes, you suddenly realize that this could be the start of something big. You're
and for Renee, some classic Ella. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.